Let's talk about uBlock origin and Facebook, because this story is both more specific and more significant than the headline suggests. The claim is that uBlock origin, probably the most widely used and technically capable ad blocker in existence, has effectively given up trying to block Facebook's native ad content, not given up on ad blocking generally, but specifically on the Facebook ad delivery system.
The reason this is technically interesting is that Facebook has been engineering against ad blockers in a specific way. Rather than serving ads from identifiable third-party domains that blockers can filter, Facebook serves ads through the same infrastructure that serves its regular content. The ads are delivered by the same servers, with the same domain names, often through the same code paths. Distinguishing them from non-ad content requires understanding the page's internal logic at runtime, which is increasingly obfuscated and changes frequently.
The HN thread has 654 comments, which is one of the larger discussions today, and it runs in several directions simultaneously. There's the technical analysis of what Facebook actually did to make blocking harder. The consensus is that their approach involves dynamically generated class names, server-side rendering of ad content mixed with regular content, and aggressive detection of extension activity. There's also a more structural argument about whether browser extension models can survive against a motivated platform with Meta's engineering resources.
From Meta's business perspective, this is enormously consequential. Facebook's advertising revenue depends on ads actually being seen. uBlock Origin has somewhere between 40 and 50 million active users, according to Extension Store statistics. If even a fraction of those users were successfully blocking Facebook ads, and now aren't, the revenue implications are measurable in the tens of millions of dollars per quarter.
Here's where the antitrust analysis becomes relevant, and I want to spend a moment on the legal framework, because it keeps coming up in tech platform discussions. The Sherman Antitrust Act, passed in 1890, prohibits two main things: anti-competitive agreements between competitors and monopolization, acquiring or maintaining monopoly power through exclusionary conduct. The key thing most people get wrong is that having a large market share doesn't make you a monopolist in the legal sense. What matters is whether you're using that market position to exclude competition through means other than being better at serving customers.
Right, and that's the distinction courts have wrestled with in cases involving Google Search, Apple's App Store, and now platform ad systems. The question isn't, does Meta have a lot of advertising revenue? It's, is Meta using its control over the Facebook platform to exclude competition in a way that harms consumers or advertisers in a separate market?
The test that courts generally apply comes from the early 1900s Standard Oil case and its descendants. Market share is relevant evidence but not sufficient. You need to show both the possession of monopoly power in a defined market and the willful acquisition or maintenance of that power through exclusionary conduct. The challenge with digital advertising is defining the market. Is the relevant market Facebook advertising, or social media advertising, or digital advertising broadly? Each definition produces a dramatically different market share number and a different legal analysis.
If Meta is engineering against ad blockers in ways that are technically within their rights as a platform operator, but that have the effect of forcing users to see ads they'd otherwise avoid, that's a business practice with significant consumer welfare implications, but it may not be antitrust conduct in the technical legal sense, because the blocker competition is happening. And the uBlock origin situation sits in this context interestingly. At the browser extension layer, not at the advertising market layer.
The lovable funding story connects here, because it illustrates where venture capital sees durable value as the iTools market matures. Lovable raised $400 million in a Series C at a valuation that puts it among the most highly valued iCoding tools companies. Lovable's product lets non-engineers build full-stack web applications through natural language prompts. It's further down the democratized software creation spectrum than tools aimed at professional developers.
The HN discussion on Lovable is skeptical in a specific way. The concern isn't whether the product works, there's acknowledgement that it does reasonably well for certain classes of applications. The concern is about the ceiling. Applications built through high-level AI generation tend to hit complexity walls, points where the generated architecture can't be extended without rewriting from scratch. Lovable's moat depends on whether they can keep pushing that ceiling up faster than the complexity of what users want to build grows.
$400 million at Series C is a bet that they can. The VCs writing that check believe that the market for non-engineer software creation is large enough, and Lovable's lead in that specific niche strong enough to justify the valuation. The build wide, ship narrow post being discussed separately today is actually a philosophical framework that applies to Lovable's situation. The argument that you should build infrastructure and capabilities more broadly than what you initially ship, so that you have room to extend into adjacent use cases without architectural rewrites.
And then there's the security story about mass vulnerability scans spoofing AI bot user agents. Someone, and the attribution is genuinely unclear from the reporting, is running automated vulnerability scans against web infrastructure while disguising their traffic as coming from legitimate AI crawlers like Claude Bot. The motivation is plausible. Security scanning traffic that looks like AI indexing is less likely to trigger rate limiters or security rules that have been configured to allow AI bots through.
This is a meaningful development for anyone running web infrastructure, because the practical response requires deciding whether to treat all AI crawler user agents as potentially hostile, which would break legitimate AI indexing, or to maintain an allow list of known good crawlers, which requires ongoing maintenance and is itself gameable.
The HN thread has 213 comments and a lot of practical discussion about WAF configuration, bot detection approaches, and whether the robots. TXD convention has any meaning left when it's trivially spoofable.
Now, before we close this segment, I want to do something we try to do every episode, which is seriously stress test one of our most confident claims today. The AI model narrative we've been running, that the frontier is genuinely crowded, that DeepSeek and QWEN are competitive with the top Western models, that the competition is shifting toward deployment and trust rather than raw capability, is the consensus view in the HN thread. Let's probe it.
The strongest challenge I'd raise is about benchmark validity. The comparisons being made in the HN thread are mostly on standard academic benchmarks, MMLU, human eval, math reasoning datasets. Those benchmarks were created before the current generation of models, and there's substantial evidence that models are now being trained specifically to perform well on them, which means benchmark performance may not accurately reflect real-world usefulness on novel tasks. If the benchmarks are saturated, competitive scores might be measuring the same optimized overfitting rather than genuine parity.
So the assumption that could be wrong is that benchmark scores equal capability. What would need to be true for the opposite conclusion, that there's still a meaningful capability gap between frontier Western models and the Chinese-developed alternatives, to hold? You need to find domains where the gap is real and consistent. Tasks that require genuine novel reasoning rather than pattern matching on training data. Tasks that require cultural and contextual understanding of domains underrepresented in Chinese training sets. Tasks requiring integration with real-time English language information.
The way to watch for this is to look at what's happening in enterprise AI adoption. If companies are actually deploying DeepSeek V4 Pro for production workloads in sensitive domains, not just running it in benchmark comparisons, that's strong evidence that the capability parity is real. If the benchmark comparisons are great, but the enterprise adoption stays concentrated in Western models, that's a signal that practitioners are finding gaps the benchmarks aren't catching.
We'd also watch DeepSeek's performance on open-ended reasoning tasks that require synthesis across genuinely novel combinations of knowledge. If those scores hold up under rigorous evaluation by researchers who aren't affiliated with any of the model developers, the parity claim becomes much stronger.